Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to the Haunted Collection. I'm coming to you from Savannah, Georgia, and this is your host, paranormal investigator, published author, and haunted collector, Kevin Kane. Thank you for tuning in. I intentionally waited an extra week to do this recording because I wanted to come to you from Savannah, Georgia. I'm sitting in the Marshall House in my hotel room, even as I record this for you. Savannah has a lot of interesting ghost stories and history. I've already taken a walking tour last night and heard some very good ghost stories. In fact, the very hotel I'm staying at right now has its own share of hauntings. The Marshall House has been around even since before the Civil War. During the Civil War, it was used as a hospital. Many soldiers came into these rooms and stayed while they healed. Some passed away and their bodies were buried here. Others had limbs amputated. Those body parts were also buried here. When the hotel was renovated years ago, they found a lot of those bones, those skeletons and body parts buried under this hotel. Some guests who've stayed here say they've seen the spirit of a Civil War soldier walking up and down the hallways outside. They've heard the footsteps, and they've seen him walking around in a few of the rooms. But he's not the only ghost here. There are many other ghosts that roam about. There are a couple of children here, for instance. There's a little boy that likes to play outside in the hallway and bounce a ball. People have heard the phantom ball bouncing late at night out in the hallway, followed by the giggles of a child. But when they investigate, they find nothing out there. There's a little girl that likes to be a little bit of a prankster. There was a guest who woke up one night to find a little girl standing at the foot of his bed. She was tickling his feet. He said he could see right through her, so he knew this was not a living, breathing child, but rather a ghost. It giggled at him and disappeared. Last night I was sitting in my hotel room, and as I was sitting here at the desk where I'm sitting right now at this very second, I felt a cat brush against my ankle. I even felt the leg of my pants move as the furry body rubbed against me, but when I looked down, there was nothing there. I found out later, when talking about the ghost, that there is a ghost cat that roams around this neighborhood and sometimes inside the Marshall House. So I believe he was coming to welcome me here. I also visited Bonaventure Cemetery today, where the statues of Gracie Watson and Corina Lawton can be located. Both are famous haunted statues. Corina's is a statue of a woman sitting on the tombstone. People have seen the expression of her face change. They've seen her head, the statue's head, move around. And they felt cold wind blow by when they sit there. I visited her for a few minutes and paid my respect, but it was very quiet, although it felt very sad there. Gracie Watson, little Gracie, she was only 6 years old when she passed away back in the 1890s. She was the daughter of a hotel proprietor, and she died at the age of six because of pneumonia. She was very well loved around here, so much so that they had a statue erected on her grave. A life-size statue made in the image of Gracie herself. People have seen her little spirit running around the cemetery and also in certain areas around the city. People leave toys for her. I myself left a little toy ball for her today. And just as I pitched the ball into her, the gate there where her statue is, a cold wind blew through and rattled the flowers on the bushes around her statue, so I think she was happy, like she was clapping. That's what it sounded like, the leaves rustling around. It sounded like clapping, like applause. So I think that makes her very happy. But I've really enjoyed my stay in Savannah. I hope I get to come back here soon. But now I'd like to move on and share a couple of stories with you while I'm here. These are a couple of my own ghost stories. One, the first one, is a story that my grandmother shared. This is the story actually about a relative, a distant relative of ours, who people believe was actually a witch. And the name of the story is My Aunt the Witch. When we lived in Townley, Alabama, it wasn't too far from Mama's old Aunt Molly. Now, she was Mama's aunt, which made her my great aunt and probably older than America itself. I was about 14 at the time we moved to Townley, and I knew Aunt Molly the last few years of her life. She lived in a pretty nice big two-story farmhouse where she lived alone out on the outskirts of town. She wasn't never married and had no kids of her own. Her farm had all kinds of livestock just like ours, and of course gardens too. Aunt Molly was well on in her years and had gotten really sick. Daddy would go over there sometimes and help out by tending to the animals and doing chores and such. There were also a few neighbors who would go out there and help out too. That is, if they weren't too scared. You see, there was a belief around Townley that my Aunt Molly was a witch. It was actually said that she practiced the black arts. Of course, there weren't ever any solid proof that she was a witch, but people still talked. I can't say I blame them much for passing those rumors. Aunt Molly was meaner than a 10-gallon drum of rattlesnakes. Sometimes when Daddy would go out to her farm, some of the kids would ride out with him. While he worked, we'd go play with the neighbor kids. Our favorite thing to play was baseball out in the field near the road. For someone supposedly sick, Aunt Molly sure had a set of lungs, because no sooner than we'd start to play than she'd come out pounding out of that front door and scream at us to knock off the noise. We'd be playing a pretty good way from her house, not making much noise at all, but still here she'd come, because it just wasn't good enough for her, no matter how far away we got. You kids cut that out before I come out there and wring your necks. That's what she'd yell at us. Then she'd press on back inside, and we'd go on back to playing and wouldn't even give a care. We knew she was just ornery. She didn't like anybody being happy or joyful. As soon as she'd hear the next noise, right on back out she'd come and yell again. Everybody would stop but me. I kept right on yelling. She really didn't like me, to say the least, because I was the one who wouldn't show her any fear. I never caused her any harm either, but she didn't like me anyhow. Mildred Lee, she'd screech, one of these days you're going to bust Hades wide open. Well, if Hades was to bust wide open, I'd yell back at her, then you, Molly, will be the first one they take. Nobody had any explanation as to why Aunt Molly was so mean, other than they believed her to be a witch or demon-filled or some such business like that. One time, when she wasn't looking, I went all around her house from top to bottom to see if I could find one of those big black pots they say witches use to mix their spells and magic potions in. I didn't find nary a one in there. Maybe she had it hid in a secret room somewhere. It's a surprise she didn't have bats hanging all over the rafters or rats scurrying about the floor. She always did wear black dresses with black shawls. She had long black hair that she kept in a tight bun on her head. Only difference was there wasn't any black pointy hat sitting on her head. But she sure had plenty of wrinkles. None of those warts on her face like witches normally have, I guess. If you want an idea of how mean Molly was, let me tell you about the Anderson girls. They were the prettiest things this side of Mississippi. One was 10 years old and the other was 7. The older one, Cindy, had a head full of the most beautiful wavy brown hair, while the younger one, Kathy, had golden curls that just wrapped themselves around her head. They were both petite and had the bluest eyes I ever did see, and they were sweeter than spring nectar. During warm weather, they would often be seen taking things like cookies or cakes that their mama helped make, or sometimes even tulips from their flower bed, and go walking around the neighborhood giving them out to the neighbors. One time they tried taking a bouquet of flowers down to Molly's house, just to try to show a little kindness. They stepped up onto her front porch and knocked on her door. She answered the door, looking down at them real gruff-like.
Our mommy and us thought you'd like these,
little Kathy chimed in as she handed up the flowers. Molly snatched the flowers, shoved the blooms into her mouth, chewed them off the stems, spit out the blooms, and tossed the bare stems down at their feet. Those poor little girls. She slammed the door shut in their faces. There was no call for such rude, evil behavior, especially toward these sweet little girls like that. But that's just how Molly got her kicks. Many a neighbor of hers reported all kinds of odd run-ins with her. There was one neighbor who comes to mind by the name of Kilmer, who lived about a mile from her. Sometime back around the year 1910, he had a pretty good-sized operational farm and some farmhands helping him run it. There was a spring out there between his property and Aunt Molly's. He and Molly always argued over who had rights to that spring. She was pretty sure the spring ran along her property, and he'd be wise to stay away from it. But he thought otherwise. Old man Kilmer was not afraid of her one bit, at least not at first. One day he needed some water from that spring and asked his farmhands if they'd go fetch him some. Unlike their boss, these farmhands were scared witless of that old witch and leery about going anywhere near her or her property. But they decided to go anyway so they wouldn't get in any trouble with their boss. So they took up their buckets and walked on out toward the spring. Later that day, those farmhands came running back to old man Kilmer with no water in their buckets and their eyes about to burst out of their sockets with fear. They told old Kilmer that when they were walking down that path toward the spring, soon as they caught sight of the water, this crazy lady with long black hair and black fingernails like claws came jumping out of the bushes at them. Her red eyes blazed like fire, and she screeched like a banshee. They took off running and did not stop till they got back to the Kilmer house. Old Kilmer thought Molly was up to her mean tricks on the boys, so he decided to go see for himself. He saddled up his horse and rode out to the spring. When he got to where it was, to his surprise, the spring had all dried up that quick. Not a drop of water could be seen. Only an empty, dry spring bed. He could not believe what he was seeing, but there it sure was, all dried up. It had to be witchery. Old man Kilmer decided to seek his water elsewhere, and he never had anything else to do with Molly again. There were several other odd tricks played on the neighbors that were chalked up to Molly's witchery. Probably the most famous was her final trick, which was played on an old man by the name of Willie. Now, Willie was somewhere in his 60s and worked for Mr. Martin, who owned the local grocery store in Townley. Mr. Martin was probably in his 60s or 70s at the time as well. He always wore a white shirt and brown suspenders and these glasses that always stayed slid to the end of his nose. Sometime around the year 1940, Molly was on her deathbed, and the doctor wasn't giving her much longer to live. Old Mr. Martin was a kind heart and decided to help her out by sending her some groceries.
He had this old horse-drawn buggy that he'd sometimes use to deliver the groceries to the elderly. He'd have Willie take that wagon and go around town doing the deliveries. Well, Willie was not too thrilled with the prospect of having to go out to Aunt Molly's farm because he'd heard all the rumors ever told about her being a witch. But he really liked Mr. Martin and did not want to let him down, so he decided to do the neighborly thing and deliver those groceries. About midday, Willie arrived down the path to Molly's house. That old place looked dark and mighty spooky with not a soul around that he could see. He stopped the horse and wagon outside the back door. He knew Molly was inside that house on her sick bed, so he decided not to go knocking on the door and pester her. Instead, he decided to unload all of the groceries right there at the back door and leave them where hopefully her hired hands would see them and get them inside for her. While he was emptying out that wagon, he got all the heebies all up his spine like you get when you feel like you're being watched. He looked all around but didn't see anyone on the grounds at all. He glanced up at the house and thought he saw some curtains moving in one of the upstairs windows, like somebody was peeking out at him. That could have been his mind playing tricks, but he wasn't too sure. So just to make sure, he unloaded the rest of those groceries faster than lightning, hopped on the seat of that wagon, and started those horses up to a full gallop so he could make a quick exit. When Willie reached the main road and made himself some distance from Molly's farm, he felt so much better and even started to whistle himself a happy tune. After a ways on down the road, a soft, cool breeze began to hit him. He kept right on whistling till he noticed something strange. The wind was whistling back the same tune at him. He looked all around at the woods on each side of the road, but he couldn't see anything except the cluster of pine trees. He glanced back at the road behind him, and that's when he saw her. Old Molly was coming down the road about 30 feet behind Willie's wagon. She was glowing and all see-through like a haint. She did not walk, and she did not run. No, she quite literally floated over the road after the wagon. Willie judged her feet had to be at least 3 feet above the ground as she floated along. Old Willie about swallowed his tongue at what he beheld. He turned back to the horse, grabbed the reins, and went to slinging them, trying to get that horse to speed up. He kept glancing back at Molly. She just floated right along with a look of blank emotion on her face. Every time he sped up, so did she. Her pace kept matched with his wagon just perfect. I don't know if Willie got a sudden burst of boldness or what happened, but for some reason he yanked hard on those reins and slowed the horse down. He looked back and saw Molly slow down right with him. He called out to her, "What do you want with me, you old witch?" She didn't answer. Instead, she kept right on staring at him. Then her eyes burst into flames and she shrieked at him. Willie started to sling those reins in his hand again and got the horse back up to full speed. At this point, they were getting pretty close to town. As he kept glancing back, Molly kept getting closer and closer to the back of that wagon, her eyes still in flames. Willie whimpered a prayer that he'd make it to civilization before she got him. He looked ahead at the road. There was a wooden-covered bridge directly ahead. A creek ran under that bridge. Willie thought he remembered hearing about how witches can't cross over water. Or was it ghosts? He kept the horse speeding and he prayed, as the hoofs thumped over that wooden bridge, that she'd disappear out from behind him. Ahead, the town appeared around the bend in the distance. Willie looked back for Molly to see if she'd disappeared. She wasn't floating down the road anymore. Nope. This time, She was sitting in the cotton-picking wagon right behind him. She grinned a row of pointed razor teeth at him. He could swear he was looking right smack dab into the face of a snake. Willie let out a terrified scream so piercing it could be heard by folks all over town. Those that heard it said it sounded like a woman screeching. Willie went into a fit of panic, threw himself forward off the wagon seat into midair, and landed on the back of that horse. He held on tight to that horse's mane, his arms and legs wrapped around its body, and his face buried into its back. He squeezed his eyes closed and prayed, "Oh Lord, oh Lord, please keep her away, please help me, keep her away." As they entered town, he kept shouting this prayer as bystanders watched the horse and wagon stampede down the street. The hooves of that horse kicked up clouds of dust all over. It was going so fast by then. People were pouring out of houses all up and down that street to watch what was going on. Finally, the horse slowed and came to a stop all on its own in front of Mr. Martin's grocery store, where it must have recognized familiar territory. Old Mr. Martin was sitting on the front porch of the store in his rocker. He saw Willie clinging to the back of that horse, just screaming away. Others gathered around to behold the spectacle of a grown man weeping like a baby. Mr. Martin called out to Willie, "What on earth are you doing on that horse? What's the matter with you, fella?" Willie lifted his face and opened his eyes to Mr. Martin. "That old witch is back there in the wagon. Get her out! Get her out!" he cried the biggest tears they'd ever seen. Mr. Martin glanced over at the wagon. "What witch? There ain't nobody there." Willie slowly turned his head back and saw that the wagon, sure enough, was completely empty. When Mr. Martin asked around, all the folks that seen the horse and wagon come stampeding into town swore on their lives that the wagon was dead empty. The only person they saw was Willie clinging to the back of that horse. Just to check on his story, the local sheriff decided to go on out to Aunt Molly's house and see for himself what he could find. When he got there and knocked on the door, one of the farmhands led him into the house. A few of Molly's family members were gathered inside in her living room. Molly was in her bedroom, still in her bed, the covers pulled up over her head. She wasn't moving a muscle, for you see, she'd been dead ever since that morning. And there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the story of our family witch, Aunt Molly, as told by my grandmother. I told it as if she were telling the story there. You can find that and many other stories about my grandmother's life in the book Thanksgiving Hen on a Chicken Shed, Stories My Grandmother Told Me. It's a book I wrote in memory of my grandmother who passed away in back in 2013. We miss her very much. And now, I'm going to move on to the last story. This is a story that you'll find in my book, The Legends of Indian Narrows, Ghostly Childhood Memoirs, the book of the scary stories I learned growing up in my neighborhood. Yes, we had a lot of spooky stories there, and a lot of haunted homes and ghostly happenings. It was just amazing. Now, this particular story I want to share I really like because it also has a little bit of history of the Native Americans included. The place my neighborhood was built used to be Cherokee Indian territory there. We used to find old arrowheads and broken pottery. Some of my ancestors were from the Cherokee Nation, so I'm very proud of our history. But here's a little story, a little dark, spooky tale from our neighborhood. It's called Devil Dog. The teenage girl ran from house to house, banging on the front doors and screaming for help. Glancing back, she saw the maniac in the mask as he continued his pursuit, a butcher knife glistening with blood in his fist.
He had already killed off her friends, and his bloodlust was far from over. This was the horror movie that played on my television screen. As I sat on my bed in my bedroom all alone, the doors closed, the lights turned out, and the window blinds drawn. Crickets chirped in the shady leaves night outside my bedroom window. It was very late on a Friday evening, and the rest of the house had turned in for the night already. The teenage boy that I was at the time, there was hardly a night I could turn in without first enjoying a great horror movie. The woman on the television continued to scream as the maniac got closer and closer. My ears perked up and I shivered. However, it wasn't the film that caused my reaction. Muting the television, I listened closely for the noise I thought I'd just heard. My room faced the front of the house, and the front porch sat right outside my bedroom window. Something moved on the porch out there. The sound managed to capture my ear over the noise on the television. As I listened, the movement came again. It was a clickety-clack sound, as if someone were walking on high heels. I realized the sound was much softer, more like paws. We owned a little Shih Tzu dog named Corky, but he had passed away a few years before. The sound I heard out on the porch that very moment reminded me of the sound of his paws when he walked across the tile floor. Moving over the bed to the window, I eased open one of the blinds to look out. The porch light was off, so it was dark, but I could make out the shapes of the rocking chairs and the potted plants out there. Nothing moved, and the sound stopped. Gazing out a few seconds longer, I finally shrugged it off and let the blinds close. Turning back to the television, I was about to turn the volume back on when the sound on the porch began again. I hurried back to the window and parted the blinds to look again, but once again I saw nothing. This time I heard a different sound. A low growl broke the stillness. It sounded like an animal right on the front porch, though I saw nothing there. A different noise followed the growl, the sound of something dragging down the banister of the porch. Deciding I wanted a better look, I left my bedroom and went down the hallway to the living room in the front of the house. My father stood in his pajamas at the front door, just about to open the door. He turned to me and whispered, "Did you hear that too?" He had just come downstairs from his bed to the kitchen for a quick snack. While in the kitchen, he heard the same growling noise and was going to inspect it when I came in. Staying behind him, I watched as he switched on the porch light and opened the door. The porch was empty. Nothing looked disturbed. The rockers and plants were where they should be. Closing the door back, he shrugged it off as possibly an animal that we'd scared off when we turned the light on. He went on back to bed, and I returned to my room. No longer in the mood for a movie, I switched off the television and climbed into bed. Sleep did not come quickly. I lay there for a while listening to the night outside. The noise never returned. The next morning, I went out on the porch for a look around. Glancing over at the banister of the porch, I froze in my tracks. We had recently painted the banister with fresh white paint just a few months prior. But now on the banister were three long claw marks going all the way down. It looked like an animal had scratched it, but an animal with only three toes. My father looked as well. The banister sat at least 5 feet above the ground and 4 feet above the porch edge, so there's no normal-sized dog that would be able to reach it well enough to make such claw marks. He could not figure out the cause, or at least not a logical explanation. Another idea did come to my mind. Looking at the marks reminded me of yet another legend I had heard in my neighborhood during my childhood years.
A tragic love story was told going back a few hundred years to when the Cherokee Indians roamed the land where our neighborhood now stood. The story involves a romance between an Indian named Ashwin and his maiden, Athalia. According to the legend, Ashwin was very tall and strong. He was given the name at birth because he was a large baby. The name meant strong horse and suited him perfectly. He possessed excellent hunting skills and made a great warrior. When he grew to manhood, he fell in love with Athalia, a young woman in the neighboring tribe. Athalia possessed a very striking beauty not overlooked by the young men of the tribes. She was a petite girl in stature with large dark eyes, long lashes, and shiny dark hair that spilled about her shoulders. Athalia was very kind to everyone, always caring for her elders and setting a perfect example for her younger generation. Her parents named her Athalia because it meant God is exalted. They saw her as not only a gift from God, but his way of displaying his own beauty through mankind. One day, Ashwin ventured off alone in the forest to make his way to the nearby creek, the one that would later be known as Village Creek, for fishing. He reached the crystal waters and prepared his spear when he heard soft footsteps crunching on the leaves behind him. Turning, he found himself gazing at young Athalia. She smiled and approached him, her eyes dazzling him instantly. They engaged in a conversation, never taking their eyes from each other. Ashwin discovered that day that Athalia's feelings for him were mutual. For weeks after, the lovers snuck off into the woods to their spot near the creek to meet and spend time alone. They began discussing their plans for the future. Ashwin wanted to marry her, and she agreed. They decided to make their intentions known to their families. Unknown to Athalia, another suitor waited in the wings. A young tribe member named Bim had been obsessing over Athalia for many years. On many occasions, he approached her and attempted to persuade her to be his bride, but Athalia spurned him. She only loved Ashwin. When the intentions of the couple were announced, Bim grew very angry with jealousy. He began plotting. On a dark, cloudy day, Bim watched as the lovers once again snuck away to spend time alone at the creek. He took his bow and arrows, said to his father that he wanted to hunt for a little while, then left to follow Athalia and Ashwin. He followed silently behind them, hiding behind trees and bushes, his mind raging with bloody thoughts. The couple reached the creek, turned to each other, and embraced in a passionate kiss. This display was the final snap in Bim's mind. Taking his bow in his hands, he loaded an arrow and carefully took aim. Athalia's back faced him and made the perfect target. He pulled back on the bow with all of his might and released. The bow sailed through the air and found its target. It struck Athalia in the back of her neck with such force that it went straight through her throat and into the chest of Ashwin, striking his heart. Bim succeeded in killing the young lovers with one shot. The Indians had a system called blood law. According to the law, if an Indian committed homicide, the punishment of that Indian would fall in the hands of the clan of the victim. The execution could be handled without trial, since blood law worked without the need for a government. The parents of Athalia and Ashwin did not hesitate. They dragged Bim into the forest. The fathers of the victims took turns stabbing him until he bled to death. His body was then thrown into the creek. Balavan, the father of Bim, was a powerful medicine man. The tribes also believed him to be an Estagli, which meant witch. Though blood law insisted that the death of the criminal brought a balance of peace and harmony between the clans of the murderer and the murdered,
Balavan could not resist being furious at the death of his own son. Using dark magic, he brought a curse down on the families. In the curse, he chose the perfect device to kill his enemies and make sure the deaths did not look like homicide. The evening that Balavan called down the curse, a large black beast entered the camp of Ashwin's people. Stalking out the teepee of Ashwin's family, it entered and proceeded to slaughter them, feeding on their bodies. The howls of the beast and the screams of the victims brought the others running. When they reached the teepee, the beast came out. It appeared like a gigantic black dog with eyes blazing red. It bared canines at least a foot in length as it growled at the tribespeople. Its paws were enormous, but possessed only three toes on each paw. They fled in fear from the bizarre creature. The beast did not pursue, but rather stalked away, its mind seemingly on another task. Making its way to the neighboring tribe, the beast dispatched the family of Athalia in much the same way. With a final howl, it disappeared into the forest. The tribes came together to mourn their loss. Some of them knew this was not a coincidence. If this had been a normal beast, why did it just attack only those two families? Why wasn't anyone else attacked or eaten? The answer came too simply. The massacre had been the work of a demon. Fingers began pointing at Balavan as the likely suspect. Before he could conjure another demon, the people raced to his teepee and dragged him away. They stoned him to death. For centuries since the death of Balavan and his son, occasional reports came forward of sightings of a large black dog with glowing red eyes wandering the forest of the area at night. The reports provide the same description of the animal: thick black hair and canines almost a foot long. No human deaths were reported to be caused by the animal other than the original victims of the story, but it still brought fear to the community at large. It was blamed for several livestock mutilations. Some say it is the devil dog conjured by Balavan. Others say it is actually his spirit, forever trapped within the demon that he conjured and roaming the land as punishment for practicing black magic. Only a few modern-day encounters were told to me as I grew up. One story involved a worker from the local power plant who was working on an electrical pole near the main road of our community. Using his belt, he shimmied up the pole to the top to work on the wires. He worked until sundown and was preparing to leave. Before he could start down the pole, he heard the growl of a large animal from below. Peering down at the shadow-covered ground below, he saw an enormous shape in the bushes nearby. Two large glowing red orbs peered up at him from the shape. Frozen in place, the worker refused to move from his spot on the pole for fear of being torn to shreds by whatever it was eyeing him from the bushes. After what seemed to him to be several minutes, the worker watched the shape finally turn and bound off into the woods. He described the creature as being the size of a lion. My sister had a strange encounter one night in the backyard that we believe could be the very same creature. When we were kids, we owned a Heinz 57 puppy dog named Terry, who stayed outside in our backyard. He was a small black dog, so black that he could not be seen very well at night. My sister stayed out with friends until sundown one summer evening. Coming home, she crossed the dark backyard, making her way to the back door. From behind, she heard rustling in the grass, like an animal approaching. The sound of heavy, dog-like snorting followed. She turned to gaze in the direction of the noise, squinting at the darkness. Thinking it was Terry, she called out his name. She was answered with a large, ferocious growl. Two red orbs suddenly shined at her through the darkness.
Without a moment's hesitation, she turned and raced to the house, bursting through the back door, slamming it behind her, and shoving the lock home. This was the last time she ever ventured in the backyard alone after dark. When the incident with the claw marks on the banister of our front porch occurred, I could not help but ask myself if we had received a visit from the famous devil dog of our neighborhood folklore. Perhaps the spirit of Balavon made his presence known, reminding us that he still roams the land in eternal agony. No logical explanation for the claw marks was ever found. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. I truly do enjoy telling these stories, especially when I'm sitting in a haunted location myself. So I'm going to go enjoy the rest of my stay here in this amazing town of Savannah, Georgia, and then I'll be heading back to Alabama soon enough. But until then, please keep enjoying those wonderful ghost stories, and by all means, happy hauntings!